Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And this week, the world got just the shot in the arm that it needed, some hope about a coronavirus vaccine. Markets rose on the news, particularly those companies hit worst by the pandemic. But Simon asks if this shift from growth to value investing is the real deal or a trap for investors. Elsewhere, the Chancellor has slammed proposed tax changes, which could see middle-class people and entrepreneurs pay more capital gains tax, calling it economic self-harm. Also today, Currys is in trouble with its customers, still. And who is liable if you trip over an electric car charging cable in the street? We ask the questions you never thought you would want to know the answer to. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, stock markets around the world rose on the news from drugs company Pfizer that a vaccine could soon be on its way, ending this Kafka-esque economic nightmare that we find ourselves in at the moment. Now, the FTSE 100 jumped 4.7% to over 6,000. The Dow was up almost 3%. What was interesting was where the biggest gains were made, notably in those stocks hit worse by the pandemic, tourism and hospitality. The COVID winners, on the other hand, well, they've done rather poorly. So is this switch of investing from growth to value, i.e. those stocks undervalued by the market, the end of the beginning, the real deal, or will investors be disappointed all over again? Firstly, Simon, welcome. What happened this week to the markets on the news from Pfizer, looking specifically, as I was talking about there, from where the money was flowing? And actually, what was that news from Pfizer? Just to keep us updated, in case people hadn't been aware of what's been talked about with a vaccine?
Well, the vaccine news from Pfizer was that in its trials so far, which were fairly extensive, involved quite a lot of people, it had been found to be 90% effective in preventing people getting coronavirus or preventing symptoms. I am not a vaccinologist, if that's what you call someone who's an expert in vaccines, or a doctor, or in any way medically qualified. So I'm not going to go too much into vaccine land. Nonetheless, this was the news that the world had been waiting for. In particular, there was this wonderful line of back to normal by spring. I've got my doubts about that, and I think you might need to stretch the concept of normal in order to squeeze it into that sentence. But, you know, there's a lot of hope of like, okay, so maybe we won't be spending the whole of winter and spring in lockdown. And maybe that suspicious extension of the furlough scheme to the end of March, whilst lockdown's only meant to last till the 2nd of December, won't mean that it's going to be another 4 or 5 months of being stuck at home. And maybe, just maybe, some of these businesses that have been absolutely hammered by lockdown might be able to get back to business. Now, there's been a tale of two stock markets ever since the coronavirus crash and lockdown-induced panic selling of shares back in late February and March. And this story has seen companies that are seen to do well when the world is turned on its head, i.e. those that operate in digital land or have heavily digitalized, or actually in some instances have seen very good sales growth off the back of lockdown. And I'm talking about a company like B&Q owner Kingfisher here, which has actually done pretty well, along with other companies like Halfords and stuff like that. Those shares have done well. I mean, over in the States, the US tech stars, okay, and also the ones coming up on their heels, i.e. Zoom and companies like that. Over here, Ocado, Just Eat, etc. These are the companies that have done well. The companies that have done badly are the ones that have an obvious severe impact on their business from continuing lockdown. And I'm thinking here, EasyJet, BA owner, IAG, airlines, you know, they've basically just got no business at the moment. They had a little bump in the summer and then they were swiftly brought back down to earth, if you can say that about an airline, grounded, so to speak. Rolls-Royce, which is an aerospace engineer, which had been heralded in recent years for shifting its business from selling big pieces of complicated engineering that it got one-hit wonder revenue from to a sort of almost like a subscription model for airlines, where they got paid on based on how many hours planes were flying. Now, this was great for Rolls-Royce until planes stopped flying. SSP is one of Britain's big companies that runs lots of brands that everybody knows, but nobody knows SSP. It owns Upper Crust, but it also runs a lot of concessions for things like M&S and stuff in airports, train stations, stuff like that. Cineworld had been on the expansion trail prior to coronavirus and then had all its cinemas shut. And there's been a vicious circle for the cinema world, whereby there's been not been any blockbusters released because the blockbusters don't want to be released by the studios because the studios don't think they're going to get the audiences, which means that people aren't willing to go back to the cinema and so on and so on. And then they shut the cinemas again. Now, what connects this disparate group of shares is that they all absolutely rocketed on Monday off the back of the vaccine news. And they're also companies that people really, 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 really didn't like in recent times. Their share prices have been hammered. So whilst the stock market, the FTSE 100, only moved about 5% on this vaccine news, which is a big jump, but by the standards of the big moves we've seen this year, it's not that much. The share prices of some of these companies went completely bananas. I mean, Rolls-Royce was up almost 45%. SSP was up 52%. Cineworld rose 40% on Monday and then did the same thing again on Tuesday. At one point, Cineworld shares had doubled in 2 days. We also saw some other stuff go up a lot. Oil company shares, so BP, Shell, anything connected to that sort of suffering economy. And at the same time, we actually saw some of those tech stars and digital stars fall. So Ocado shares fell by 12%. And what you're looking at here was a combination of two things. Firstly, there's this question that we're going to come on to in a minute as whether this is a shift from growth investing to value investing, whether this is a return of the dash for trash phenomenon that we saw after the financial crisis. And secondly, what we witnessed was another bit of lockdown panic buying, except people weren't rushing to stuff toilet rolls and pasta into their trolleys. This time around, they were rushing to stuff beaten down shares into their trolleys. And you saw this, I think, basically from institutional investors. So I reckon there was a few fund managers out there and traders going, right, let's make some quick money here. And if you acted fast on Monday, you would have made quick money. But a lot of the people who made the money were the people who'd already bought the beaten down shares prior to Monday. And you also see a lot of personal investors who were quick off the mark going, right, whew, I'm going to buy some shares here, see if I can make a quick buck. Now, whether that's investing or whether that's trading.
Some people have a bit of a problem with that.
Some people did.
Have a bit of a problem this week, especially with Hargreaves and AJ Bell customers.
They did. So we heard a little bit about this on Monday from people, a few emails in and on Twitter, people saying that Hargreaves Lansdown was having an absolute mare and that people were locked out of accounts. They couldn't get into accounts. There was, when they were making trades, there was some funny stuff going on. And we got in touch with Hargreaves and also with the other major platforms. And they told us that they had their busiest day ever in terms of volumes of trading, which, I mean, that's big. Hargreaves customers were struggling to get into their account. That meant that they weren't able to make the trades that they wanted to, either to sell banks and profits or maybe to buy and try and clamber on board the runaway train as it careered out of the station. AJ Bell had some problems as well. Interactive Investor said it didn't have problems, but it did have a extremely big trading day. So for some of those investors, the question is now, you know, for those Hargreaves Lansdown, which is the biggest platform and the one that there was the biggest kerfuffle over, what do you do now? Now, Hargreaves have said if people think they've lost out to get in touch, and, you know, obviously it's got an official complaints procedure and, you know, it can have to do stuff to help them out. It's very difficult to prove your intention though, isn't it? You know, that I wanted to log into my platform to buy some Rolls-Royce shares at 11:30 on Monday, and that means that I missed out on a 44% gain because I would have sold them at the end of that day thing, or I have some Rolls-Royce shares and I wanted to sell them, but I couldn't sell them. How do you know that person's telling the truth? Or how do you prove you're telling the truth if you are telling the truth? So whenever you get a scenario like this, it's a little bit of a murky one. But if you are somebody who was affected, then you should get in touch and make a complaint to your platform. And if you're not happy with the response, then you can go to the Ombudsman.
All right, well, let's move away from people struggling to actually buy or to invest. You talked about the debate around shifting pattern from growth to value investing. Before we go into that, and whether it's something permanent, whether it's a false dawn, whatever it might be, just explain exactly what that means. Growth, value investing.
Yes.
What on growth earth, investing and value investing.
What on earth am I talking about? Yes. So growth investing involves buying companies that have a robust promise of future growth. And that's what you are targeting. You are saying, is company A that I'm looking at here going to be able to make continual profits in years to come and continue to grow those profits to increase its business, to pull in more customers and to make more revenue and greater profits from those customers? And it might possibly involve the fact that that company doesn't even make any profits now, but you can see it making some profits in the future. And so you are investing for growth. You're backing that company's ability to grow. And you are often willing to pay a higher price for it. Growth investing tends to be characterized by people paying higher valuations for shares. So for example, company A might be able to promise many, many years of growth. Company B might look like it's in an industry in structural decline. So you are willing to pay a higher multiple of its earnings for company A than you are for company B. Even if company B actually makes bigger profits than company A at the moment and pays you a bigger dividend, because you think that eventually company A is going to overtake company B. Now, to take two examples of that, let's look at a company like Facebook and a company like BP. Facebook, obviously, a profit-making machine. It's effectively a global advertising business with an extreme volume of data on its customers and the ability to let advertisers target who they reach by a number of data points. So you can say, I want to advertise to a person who fits five different attributes, and Facebook will chuck you that person who fits those five different attributes. And Facebook's great advantage over lots of other companies is it doesn't even have to go looking for some of this information, because we just actively tell it. We actively constantly tell it what we're doing with our lives, be that on Facebook, be that on Instagram, be that on WhatsApp, which is a platform that it owns and hasn't even really monetized. So people look at Facebook and they go, Facebook has the ability to just keep growing and growing and growing in terms of its revenue and its profits and probably its customer base. And so they're willing to pay, you know, a higher multiple on a price to earnings basis, the price being the share price, the earnings being the earnings per share, aka profits that it makes. And people were willing to do that even before Facebook was making profits. The people were willing to back the company on that principle. Now, take BP. BP is a global company, global oil and energy company, and it's made money for years and years and years. And the one thing that you know is that people need to fill their cars up with petrol, and that people are going to need oil is what makes the world go round, still what makes the world go round. But that's changing. The shift towards greener energy, the shift towards electric cars, the political weight coming down against the old-fashioned energy companies means that BP is effectively a company that is operating in an industry that is in structural decline. And so BP is not looked at as a growth share. And in fact, because BP is so unloved and has been so unloved, its share prices had fallen to a level that was pretty much as low as it's been. It's on a very lowly valuation in terms of price to earnings. It pays a big dividend. And so BP could be considered what is known as a value stock, i.e. something that is undervalued, that maybe the market's wrong on this. The market's too damn pessimistic on this company. BP I've used as an example, and I should mention here that I do actually own some BP shares because I think that maybe the market is too pessimistic on BP. It has become too pessimistic on BP. I own shares in lots of other companies as well, not just BP. But I should mention that as I use the example of BP. Now, what's interesting is that there's obviously a very large playing field in between these two elements of growth and value, and it's a spectrum. You know, it's not just a black and white scenario, one at one end, one at the other end. They're often talked about as polar opposites, but they're not polar opposites. So you can go for a combination of growth and value. You can go for a company that you think is undervalued by the market but still has the ability to grow in the future. And that's more the kind of Warren Buffett school of value investing, or the Terry Smith school of value investing. Is, you know, they're actually buying companies that are relatively expensive, you know, on a valuation method like price to earnings, but they do have the ability to continue delivering solid growth, not shoot the lights out growth, but solid growth over the years. And they think that the market is undervaluing what that is worth to people as investors. So, but when we talk about the shift from one to the other, it's because growth has had it pretty much all its way for a very long time now. Post kind of financial, after the initial financial crisis rally, it's all been growth, 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 growth. And if you look at the companies that we talk about all the time, those that have come to completely dominate our lives, those US tech stars, that's the growth, you know, part of the market. Then the question is, when does value come back? And will value come back? And values.
Well, answer your own question. You put it to me. End of the beginning, real deal, disappointment for investors.
Value investing's had a lot of false dawns in recent years. People keep saying value will come back, value will come back. Value is really good value now because nobody likes value. And value has a little rally and then it falls away again as people go back to growth.
But is it just like all things that seem to be economic? It goes in cycles.
That's the idea. Expect the cycle of value to have come back by now. But where the argument is that we might now see this shift is that basically, if you are going to see a recovery anyway, right, that is coming off the back of something else. If companies are going to start making greater profits, if they're going to start seeing their revenues rise, why pay up more for the expensive growth companies if you can just buy the cheap ones that are going to do that anyway? And the reason why the cheap ones are maybe going to do that anyway is because of this idea of the vaccine coming in. So if it can deliver some form of return to normality and recovery, there's no point paying the high price that growth shares command when you can buy a lower one for companies that are just going to benefit anyway and might be trading on extremely cheap valuations. For example, the oil companies, the airlines, the Cineworlds of this world. You know, why do you need to pay a huge multiple for Zoom and its promise of growth when you know that the moment the cinemas can reopen, Cineworld's going to start making money again? The problem is you've got to be a bit careful about what you're buying here, because if you're picking individual shares, you need to do proper research and due diligence, and you need a portfolio of enough different companies doing different things that you've spread your risk. On a day like Monday, you can just chuck some money at the wall and see if you can make a quick buck. But investing's not—that's not really what investing's about. Investing is about the longer term, and there is lots of evidence that says if you buy into cheaper stuff, then it pays off in the long run if you're patient. But you might have to be patient. There is also a famous saying that the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. So you might, this rally's already tailed off a little bit at the end of this week. And if you use a fund manager or a tracker, you need to do some decent digging into the track record of that fund manager, the strategy of that tracker fund, what's really in it, in that fund, that investment, that ETF. If you're going to look at shares yourself, then you need to be willing to actually, you know, read the company reports, look at the fundamentals, look at the metrics, and so on. And I think probably there is a reasonable case to be made for the fact that value will return at some point. Certainly, even if you look over the very, very long term, investors have tended to do better buying stuff when it is cheap and then holding on to it than buying the really expensive stuff. Now, over the past decade, we've seen the expensive stuff just do spectacularly. You know, we've seen really spectacular gains from those US tech stars, for example, as because the world has suddenly changed dramatically with the internet and digitalization, and companies have suddenly started making serious money off that and creating, in many instances, monopolies or oligopolies. They have too much control. Now, the question is that going to get broken up? We keep getting threats of it. Never really seems to happen. Or is there going to be something that makes these companies less profitable in the future? I don't know. There's then been this whole question over the US stock market on some measures of valuation, price to earnings, cyclically adjusted price to earnings and things like that. It's as expensive, you know, as it's ever been. It's at kind of 1920s boom levels and things like that. And people keep saying, well, that's going to come to an end. It's going to come to an end. And it's just kept going up, and it's staged a remarkable rally since the coronavirus crisis. But, you know, everything comes to an end. As you said, it all moves in cycles, doesn't it? And the question is now, have we seen a shift? But if we have seen a shift, it's not as simple as basically vaccine news comes out on Monday and that's it. It's done.
Exactly.
It's going to be a sort of longer, more drawn out process over 3 months, 6 months, whatever. It's not I've suddenly got to dive in now, otherwise I've totally missed the window of opportunity. It's a keep an eye on it, do some thinking, and maybe look at your investments, see whether they're right for you and whether you're taking the right level of risk for the rewards that you want, and then B, maybe think about, do you want to shift the strategy if you believe that is the case? Or you might think, actually, this is completely wrong and this is just a little sugar rush and it's going to pass, and actually the new defensive companies are those digital stocks that can just keep making money come what may as the world changes.
Well, this is why I asked you at the start about the vaccine and the news around it. I wasn't expecting a kind of virologist answer, but it was more, I mean, is this a full-blown vaccine and hallelujah, by 2021 we're all safe? The answer is no, that's not the case. I mean, they're talking about rolling it out to people like you and I, Simon, I think by December next year. So that's a whole year in theory, and theory is a lot of this, that we could have a vaccine where everybody is safe and vaccinated against a virus. Why I was thinking about that was it takes time for changes to embed in people's minds, this working from home, the digital conversion, etc. If we had a vaccination that came along in the next month or so, then maybe all the things that we've got used to, going online, etc., would probably dissipate, and we could get a lot closer to the old normal than we would if we are still going to have restrictions for some time yet. And it seems to me, until we get a vaccine rolled out to everybody in this country, we will have restrictions in some form or another. They're talking about when lockdown is lifted, we're going to have a tier four, perhaps. So it doesn't look like it's, you know, going to get that much cushier. So that was my thinking. How much of a change is going to be fundamentally made in the minds of Britons, and therefore the impact that will have on where we want to put our money?
This is very true, in that there was a scenario on Monday where a press conference was called, you know, for that evening with Boris and some of the science crew. And I think the general mood of the press conference was, this is very good news and very exciting, but chill your boots, people. Calm down. Firstly, there was a very heavy emphasis on, please, please still follow the rules. Please, please, please don't think that you can just go out and do stuff now. We're still in lockdown. When we come out of lockdown, as you said, there's talk of tier four. which is an interesting one because the way the tiers work, the third tier is something like very, very high. And so tier four must be presumably called something like, but also this, we can't vaccinate everyone immediately. We've bought what, 10 million doses of this thing. We've pre-ordered 10 million doses. And that they have, you have to have two shots. So that's 5 million people. Is that correct? I think, forgive me if it's not. But you've got to roll it out. You've got to give it to people. And they are talking about vaccinating people pre-Christmas. You know, there was all this stuff of NHS told to get ready to start vaccinating people from the start of next month. But it's going to take a long time before it filters down to a lot of the population. I mean, you suggested that, you know, people like you and me might be the end of next year. I think it would probably be the third of whenever, to be perfectly honest. I won't say the third of never because that makes it sound like an anti-vaxxing statement. But I think it will be, you know, the third of whenever. So there's a lot of people out there who will be waiting a long time. But just because they haven't been vaccinated doesn't mean you can't go back to, you know, a considerable distance towards normality. Because if you vaccinate the most vulnerable people and it works, you know, because obviously this is the thing, is that a test has been done, but it's not been, you know, that's not actually a rolling out the vaccine to the population and it's working scenario. That's the true test of something.
Yeah.
If you get back a considerable distance towards normal, then yeah, things will pick up. I mean, you only have to look at a recent period to see what that is like. Look at what life was like over late summer, the sort of July, August period. Life was very much, for a lot of people, unless they were the kind of person who was deeply concerned about going out, either for the reasons of shielding or because they were very worried about COVID still, life for a lot of people went back to something that looked a lot like normal, but just for many of them involved a lot more working from home than it, if they were office workers, than it did. But for those who can't work from home, it didn't. You know, they were out to work every day. People are still out to work every day, even in lockdown. The GDP figures we had yesterday showed a big, big bounce back in the economy over that quarter, 15.5%. The Bank of England, as we talked about last week, has forecast that we're going to now see a 2% decline in the final quarter. Maybe it won't be that bad. Maybe we'll see less than that. Maybe we'll see more. But the expectation is hopefully that things get back to growth at the start of next year. If we can come out of lockdown, if we start vaccinating people, if we've got this hope that we are going to, you know, inch our way back towards normality, then maybe that will happen. And you will see all of a sudden things like hospitality company shares, leisure industry company shares, airline shares suddenly make something of a return, because investors have short memories. They very quickly forget all of the money that was lost over the last year. And they very quickly learn to retrain their brains onto all of the money that's going to be made over the next year. It's that classic thing where you get a new chief executive come into a company and he kitchen sinks all the bad news, or she kitchen sinks all the bad news. And the idea is that just bung it all in the results, make everything look as bad as possible, because then when things get slightly better, everyone will go, woohoo, isn't this person doing a great job? And that's the same thing that you are going to see laid out across company after company after company when this thing finally starts to go away.
The question is, though, Simon, are we going to get another eat out to help out from Rishi?
I saw that those stories yesterday, and I was like thinking, there's no way they're going to do that again.
Well, we shall see.
They've got so much criticism for that. I literally sit here waiting to be proved wrong, though, because if you had told me when I was down at my friend's house on New Year's Eve, I nearly said 2019, that we'd all be, you know, by order of the government and the law and the threat of a however many thousands of pound fine, banned from leaving our houses at one point this year, I'd have laughed at you. And then if you said, but you'll also get the government state subsidizing meals in restaurants and pubs by 50%, I'd have said, okay, maybe you should put the drink down.
And here we are. So yeah. Who knows? Elsewhere, move on from that. Suggestions about how we might start enormous corona as a country. The dependent tax recommended a major overhaul of capital gains. Overhaul read multi-billion pound tax savers and entrepreneurs. The chancellor, however, has would inflict self-harm. Who is proposed and why, Simon?
There's been a bit of fuss about the fact that, and it always gets talked about as like hedge fund managers paying low rates of tax or, you know, real fat cats, people, big share options, people who manage to get paid smaller salaries. When I say smaller salaries, most of the people doing this are being paid hundreds of thousands of pounds in their salaries, but they're also being paid millions of pounds in share options. And then when they sell the share options, they just pay capital gains tax and stuff. So the idea is that you should equalize the levels of the tax. You should push the tax rates back up. And the Chancellor asked the Office of Tax Simplification to have a look at this, and it has returned with its report. And its report makes ugly reading for anybody who has built up a substantial investment portfolio outside of an ISA or pension, or anybody who has a buy-to-let that they've made a considerable amount of money on. And its report is essentially suggesting that it might be a good idea to get these rates of tax to be level, that the annual tax-free allowance on capital gains should be slashed, maybe to as low as £2,000 or £4,000. Does also hint that maybe it might be an idea to bring back some form of indexation, taper relief type thing that does reward the long-term holding of assets. Ultimately, what this is something that will take a large amount of money from the people judged to be wealthier who have more capital, effectively. Mm-hmm. How successful it would be is a whole other matter, however.
Well, the Institute for Public Policy Research estimates that the government could raise an extra $90 billion over 5 years if CGT and income tax are aligned.
It should be noted.
We need that money, though, don't we?
We do need that money. However, it should be noted that the IPPR is a left-leaning think tank that is strongly in support of this. So yes, it's done its numbers, and its numbers are big. You can probably pull out a report from another think tank that thinks the opposite, that will give you a much, much smaller number. So sorry, just to say that.
No, that's fair enough. You're basically just saying because they're political, they choke. No, I'm joking. I get your point. I get your point. But is there some research which says it's not going to create any money, and therefore this is a completely wasted venture and could blow up in the government's or the Treasury's face?
Yeah, I mean, so there's potentially an argument that there's an argument that capital gains tax skews behaviour, but that this kind of change could skew behaviour even more. So there is an argument that basically the way to encourage people to sell assets, for example, buy-to-lets is a classic example. And this idea was actually rolled out a few years back as a potential George Osborne rabbit out of the hat in a budget, was cutting capital gains tax, making the tax bill lower in order to encourage landlords and second homeowners to sell up. So they would put their properties onto the market, thus increasing the number of properties. So therefore, first-time buyers and home movers would get a greater supply, because actually, whilst rationally it may not make sense, if you look at people's behavior, people will not sell assets that they have made lots of money on and realize the profits because of the big tax bill that they will pay if they do so. Now, they will still make money. Okay, this is the irony, is like they're still going to end up with more money than the tax that they pay. We don't have 100% rate of tax, but they do avoid making these sales. So this could be true of people selling properties. It could be true of people selling businesses. It could be true of people selling investments. Now, also, whilst there is an argument this will hit the wealthiest in society, the talk of the hedge fund managers, the high flyers, the executives being paid vast sums of money in share options. And it's certainly true that it would, on paper, affect them. I'm pretty sure that those people will work out some way of minimizing their tax bill, because that's what they do. That's how they roll, basically. The people who will actually feel the most pain from it will be the more ordinary people who have built up who have used buy-to-let to build up a sort of a fund for retirement, or who have built up large amounts of investments outside of ISAs. Now, the ISA allowance is £20,000 a year at the moment, right, which is extremely generous, okay? And if you were starting now, then you would have very little excuse not to basically fill up your ISA as much as possible and build up the funds that are outside of your pension that you're going to rely on in later life for your income in an ISA. But the ISA allowance was much, much lower in the past. And so actually there are people out there who, you know, long term have built up, you know, substantial investments in order to help fund their retirement, who, if you suddenly saw the annual allowance slashed and the rate go up, would end up paying more tax, and it will disproportionately affect them in a way that it will not disproportionately affect your hedge fund manager or your company chief executive, who's basically got pots of cash anyway, and a slightly higher tax bill is an annoyance rather than something that materially affects them. However, I think that at some point we are probably going to see this come in. I don't necessarily think Rishi's going to do it, and I don't necessarily think he's going to do it soon, because I think it would be very unpopular. It would see a backlash, and I think the last thing the Tory party wants is a tax backlash from its own voters, seeing as it's managed to go from the Boris bounce and resounding election victory to being in complete disarray in a record period of time. And I think I reckon there's probably some people in the Tory party who'd like Rishi to do it, because they think he's a bit too popular at the moment, and he's the only one that people think is competent. So actually something that brings him down a peg or two, they might quite like. But I'm not so sure they're going to do this. I think we'll probably let this one ride for a while. An interesting aside on this, though, is that the Labour Party floated this very similar idea in its manifesto, the Corbyn manifesto. But it talked about bringing in a risk-free rate of return. And you would only be taxed on gains above the risk-free rate of return. The risk-free rate of return was linked to government bond yields, basically. So the investment return you would get on a risk-free asset, so government bond yields, UK government bond yields, are considered to be the risk-free asset. Interestingly, when I ran the numbers on this, it showed that actually for some long-term buy-to-let landlords, i.e. someone who'd made £100,000 on their property over 10 years, they could actually end up paying less capital gains tax rather than compared to the current system. That if you do introduce that risk-free rate of return, indexation, taper relief, whatever you want to call it, then actually people who have held assets for the long term and have made substantial profits on them could, in some scenarios, end up paying less. So look into the small print, because it might not be all bad, people.
All right, let's leave that to one side. I'm trying to scrape the barrel, Simon, as always, in looking at positive things to come out of all this madness. But maybe one would be, perhaps we're all a bit more clued up about our consumer rights. And because, let's be honest, we've had to. From airlines and travel companies refusing refunds for cancelled flights and holidays, to more of us, of course, ordering online and all the trouble that comes from that. Because there's one thing more frustrating than getting an item delivered that's wrong or faulty and knowing that you have to send it back, particularly in lockdown, nightmare. And that's having to chase up a refund again and again and again. But this is exactly what's been happening with customers of Currys PC World since May, or perhaps earlier, but May is when you first started getting reports of this. So, Simon, what has been going on? What are your readers telling you?
They're telling us that Currys PC World appears to have had something of a lockdown meltdown. We have been inundated with emails from customers who feel they're being fobbed off, not receiving refunds, struggling to contact customer services, chasing down missing orders. We've first reported, as you said, some of this going on back in May. And since then, more than 300 people have emailed to say they're having problems with the firm. Many say items have turned up faulty. They're then unable to obtain a refund or a replacement. Others have said that orders have just never arrived. then even despite stores reopening, as lockdown restrictions were eased in the first place, customers still, you know, didn't want to go into the shop, so they still ordered online, and the problems continued. Since we published this article, since Grace did this, she spoke to lots of people who've been having these problems. She spoke to Currys. We've had loads more complaints as well. It's the classic, publish an article about something and then a lot of people get in touch. I mean, one of the customers, a reader called Simon, not me, said, "It's quite impossible to contact Currys by any means. I tried one phone call on September the 22nd and was told my order number would be passed on to the appropriate department. The website advises there is a waiting time of 1 hour, so go to its web chat, but that doesn't respond. There is no customer service email." So people are just going around in circles. Another reader said he can't get through to Currys at all to tell them that his new cooker, ordered through the website, arrived faulty. Despite having an electrician install it, the oven doesn't turn on. He said, "I've tried for weeks to get through to Currys on the phone. Either it's when I finish work and then they state they're closed, or at weekends when I have no luck getting through either. I tried during office hours, go through the automated options, get past a range master, as it's now outside the 21 or 30 days from purchase. Tried logging a complaint with range master, no response from them either." So basically people have been taken around in circles. Currys has obviously said that, you know, it's sorry for people having problems. Who haven't received the standard of customer service they expect. It says, "We've upgraded our systems to ensure refunds are processed as quickly as possible. We understand the customer frustration and would like to apologise to those affected." It's also then been in touch with us since to say that it's going to try and work with us to get through all of these complaints we've had and try and fix stuff for all these people affected.
Okay, well, that's good news. Do you actually think that people are more clued up about consumer rights, Simon, because of coronavirus? Or am I just ever so hopeful?
I'm not so sure they are. Maybe a little bit. They've certainly spent a considerable amount of time fighting for refunds on flights and holidays. So maybe they're slightly more clued up. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, look, under the Consumer Rights Act 2015, your purchases are protected should something go wrong. That act says stuff must be of a satisfactory quality, fit for purpose, as described, and last a reasonable length of time. And items must be installed correctly if installation is part of the contract. If you receive a faulty item, it's not as described, etc., you can ask for a refund. You must have proof of purchase. Doesn't have to be a receipt. Could be a bank statement. The problem is that you're meant to go to the person who sold it to you, to the retailer. And if the retailer, you just can't get them to respond, etc., or you can't get hold of the retailer, then you obviously have a problem. But the answer is, unfortunately, just keep going. Keep on trucking.
All right, then. So, sorry about that. Finally, one of my favourite stories on the This Is Money website this week, because it is exactly the sort of brilliantly childlike almost question that I would want to know the answer to. Dad, you know those electric cars? Yes, Georgie. You know how they have these big long cables to charge their cars in the street? From houses. Yes, Georgie. If I trip over one, can we sue and win squillions of pounds? Simon, can you explain this story?
Okay, so where does this story come from? Well, this story comes from the regular questions we get from people who would like to buy an electric car but don't have any off-street parking, so that, which means that you can't charge it at home. Now, having worked my way through a variety of electric cars on test, most recently I have been getting them in for review to test out the most popular ones: Tesla Model 3, Renault Zoe. I've got a Peugeot E208 at the moment. The issue is that for most people, the way an electric car works, as in it's going to work for you, is if you have a home charger, so a wall box fitted. And that means that you can charge your car at, say, seven kilowatts, which basically means you can charge your car in full over about 5 to 7 hours, basically. If you want to plug it into the mains to charge it, then it's going to take you about 20 hours to charge your car. So what a lot of people who buy electric cars do is they get a special wall box fitted, either in their garage or on their drive, and then they can plug their car in, it charges nicely. There are public charging points available, but they are few and far between still. There's a lot more of them in London, major cities, for example. Out here in the town that I live in, that is not that far from London, there's about three or four, and they're not very fast. And that's a town of, I think, about 30,000 people. So if a meaningful number of people got electric cars here, you'd be stuffed unless they were able to charge them at home. Now, that's all very well and good, but what if you don't have a drive or a garage? I'm going to work on the basis that if you don't have a garage, if you don't have a drive, you also don't have a garage. Can you just plug it into your house and take the lead over the pavement? Just plug it into your normal plug socket, take the lead over the pavement. And pretty much a lot of people will have seen people do this. Sometimes they just leave the lead over the pavement. Sometimes they put those funny little cover ramp things on them so that people aren't just tripping over the lead. Those are the more professional options. In one instance, as our deputy motoring editor, Rob Hull, has seen, there is an enterprising soul near him who takes the lead out of a first floor window across to a street tree and then winds the lead down the tree, thus meaning that nobody is going to trip over the lead because the lead is well above head height, and then plugs it into their car, which is a personal favourite of mine. But if you do have that cable there running across the pavement, is it A, illegal, and B, if someone trips over it, are you going to be in a lot of trouble and get sued, as you asked? Well, firstly, interestingly, it's not actually illegal. A lot of people think that it is and that you're not allowed to do it, but it's not. We spoke to the local government association, and they said that basically there's no legislation that it is aware of that would make the inconsiderate placing of a charging cable illegal. It also said that if someone was to injure themselves tripping over a charging cable across the pavement, the owner could potentially be liable through a personal injury lawyer and motor insurer if they decided to. So you basically take on a personal injury lawyer and you go after someone's insurer. Mm-hmm. But we've actually been told by a lawyer and an insurer that it's not quite so cut and dry and that it might be very, very difficult to prove that. The lawyer that we spoke to, Catherine Hart, partner at Personal Injury Law Experts, Lyme Solicitors, said your accident probably happened on a public highway, so you cannot claim the negligent person is the occupier of that highway. You need to argue that common law negligence, they owed you a duty of care, they breached that duty, that it was reasonably foreseeable that the injury would occur and that you would have been injured. This means that you basically need to prove not only that that person was negligent, but that you weren't negligent, i.e., you know, were you looking where you were going? Has the person who put that cable over the pavement taken reasonable steps to make sure that people wouldn't trip over it? And did you take reasonable steps to make sure that you just didn't trip over something in front of you? Just because you trip over a paving slab doesn't mean that the council is at fault, for example, and just because you trip over an extension lead doesn't mean the person is at fault. We spoke to motor insurer as well, LV, who told us if someone was to trip or fall over a charging cable and our customer was found legally responsible or negligent, our policy would cover it under liability to other people. With these types of claims, our customer would have to be found negligent in a court of law, and there would be other things to consider too, such as the pedestrian perhaps not paying attention to where they were walking because, for example, they were looking at their phone. There could likely be an element of contributory negligence on their part, and LV said it hasn't had any cases of this type yet, and that an injury would need to be pretty severe to initiate a claim, and tripping over on a pavement may not necessarily result in a life-threatening or altering injury in most cases. Interestingly though, insurance policies do cover people now for tripping over their own charging cables on their electric cars.
Wow.
So if you injure yourself with your own cable on your own car charging, you are covered under most policies. Yeah.
Marvellous what you lot find out, honestly. Anyway, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, really anything, I mean, just be creative because they like those questions, or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate in the reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.